You're listening to a Bellingcat Discord server stage talk titled Justice and Accountability with Open Source Research. We were joined by Natasha Perifacina, a consultant from Bellingcat's Justice and Accountability unit. Natasha is an architect, but in recent months has been putting her skill set to use, helping to identify possible incidents of civilian harm in Ukraine and helping package that data and information up for use in a courtroom in hopeful preparation for trials on some of the witnessed atrocity crimes. The Bellingcat Justice and Accountability Unit is a small team consisting of researchers and lawyers alongside the Global Legal Action Network, and their mission is to create a usable methodology to help open source evidence be seen as admissible in court. In the talk, Natasha details this further and demonstrates how the team is set up to serve the pursuit of such a methodology. You can find links to all the resources mentioned in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Marr, on Thursday the 25th of April in the Bellingcat Discord server. Hello all. I'm excited that today we're joined by Natasha Perifacina from our Justice and Accountability Unit. Bellingcat's Justice and Accountability Unit is a joint project with the Global Legal Action Network. Through years of collaboration, we have developed and tested a step-by-step methodology for investigators to follow, which will ensure that courts can put aside any skepticism and place appropriate trust in open source information. Its aim is to ensure that any material discovered by Bellingcat's dedicated Justice and Accountability Unit is gathered in accordance with rules on admissibility of evidence, so as to make it suitable for use in future legal proceedings and other accountability processes. It is the product of years of testing and development and has benefited from input from legal and investigative practitioners, and the process can be adopted and used by investigators anywhere, hopefully. It was originally born from a discussion in a workshop back in 2018, and Natasha is a consultant in that unit, working separately from our editorial. Natasha is going to shine a light on the most recent work by the unit and why it's a big deal. Please put all of your questions in the chat as she's talking, and I'll ask them as we move into the Q&A section. So Natasha, now is the time, if that's okay, for you to take the stage and tell us a little bit about the Justice and Accountability Unit.
Perfect. Hello all. Thank you for joining. My name is Natasha, and I'm part of the Justice and Accountability team at Bellingcat, a team that consists of researchers, investigators, lawyers. Me personally, I have a background in architecture, so I specialize in kind of spatial side of investigations. But today I will kind of walk you through the kind of stuff that we do as part of the JNA units, its relationship to kind of the main team of Bellingcat, the goals and intentions behind the creation of the unit, and kind of processes and outcomes of our mission. The JNA is kind of a joint initiative of GLAN and Bellingcat. Our mission is kind of to design, apply, and share methods of kind of ensuring viability of online open source information in judicial processes. Courts are not very used with dealing with kind of digital evidence that whose origins are unknown, and so there's kind of a significant risk that there is the full potential of the content that is available online could be missed, especially if the information is not deemed unreliable or inadmissible. So we have, as part of the unit, we kind of methodology, which is kind of designed to satisfy the criteria for admissibility in courts, and so that investigators like myself could follow and kind of get predictable and consistent results. So there is, at the moment, there is no international kind of legal standards that kind of regulate the admissibility of evidence. So our methodology is kind of designed to cover that. And it regulates things like the setup, like the framework for investigators to use, kind of being aware of the bias involved in this process, kind of the technical setup, such as kind of using a single VPN node for all of the investigators. The kind of questions that we need to address and answer as part of every investigation. And also how to preserve and archive the process and the evidence that we found and produced. That is done by an external, or the archiving process is done by an external body called Mnemonic Labs. And the framework, we use the England and Wales jurisdictions because that has the strictest evidentiary standards. So that we assume that if the evidence that we produce for these jurisdictions that is successful there, it will have a higher chance of being successful in other jurisdictions. That said, our methodology will require local adaptation for every conflict, as it has its own kind of qualities and realities. When developing this methodology, we did follow an existing framework on digital open source investigation, such as the Berkeley Protocol. And it's the methodology that we developed is not contradicting that. The Berkeley Protocol, the difference would be that it's kind of a framework, while the methodology that we have developed at the JNA unit is actually more of kind of a practical roadmap for investigators to use. Also, like to explain the entire process, it's important to mention that a big process that is undertaken by our team is actually the collection and the preservation of the audiovisual materials found on social media. And you might assume that stuff that is published online, like on Twitter, Telegram, will stay there forever. But in fact, this stuff tends to disappear. So our job is to archive it and make it searchable, navigatable. So we collect claims from these social media platforms like Telegram, TikTok. And then we decide whether that is relevant for this kind of triage is like, after collecting, we decide whether that's relevant or not for our future work, as we are particularly interested in kind of civilian harm incidents. This is then logged into this database called Atlas, which is this is something that the Bellingcat's volunteer community helps us curate and kind of geolocate. Over the past 2 years, we have invaluable help from the volunteers helping us track and document civilian harm cases in Ukraine. And with the support of the members, we've geolocated over 1,700 incidents to date. Every kind of completed incident that is verified by a JNA unit member then goes onto this time map, which is accessible to anyone online. The incidents can be filtered by various criteria like location, time, and kind of munition use, which is like makes it much more easy to as an interface to use for future work and future analysis. Each cluster on the map, each cluster, like the purple dots that you can see on the map, is actually consists of incidents, each one kind of collected from a social media post. After that part is done, we then compile the found data into this manageable database. Is also a way of processing and allows us to process, analyze the content. After systematically archiving found evidence, with kind of organization called Mnemonic, as I mentioned before. We select evidence that we think we consider more valuable potentially to prosecutors. And we produce a more kind of detailed, granular report on this chosen incidents following our methodology step by step. After this process is done, this evidentiary kind of we log this into this last bit on the right of the screen to the evidentiary database called UWASI that is also available for other organizations that are working on legal accountability. We don't only kind of develop and kind of populate the this framework, but we also are testing our methodology extensively. And kind of the because of issues surrounding the admissibility of digital and open information have not been fully tested in courts of England and Wales. So this hearing that we this mock hearing that was conducted on a project in Yemen, it was kind of. He's like exploring the admissibility of online and open source evidence in this trial. This is aimed to kind of robustly test the methodology developed by Benincat and Glahn against the traditional principles of evidence in order to anticipate potential challenges and also adjust and strengthen our methodology. I think one of like important things to consider is like why this is done is like why open source researchers cannot submit their original work to court without following the methodology, and that's actually the kind of the courts they have a specific criteria for admitting information as evidence, and so this kind of document, this methodology that we designed. Satisfy is like designed and adjusted so that it satisfies this criteria. So the investigators can follow the step by step process and produce predictable results. This also produces a very kind of transparent process, which can be replicated if someone. Follows the steps described in every report that we produce. And so why haven't you seen the publications from our unit on Bellycat's website, you might wonder. And that's because the JNA unit operates, although within Bellycat, it actually is firewalled from the rest of the organization. And it has its own communication networks, and those at Bellycat who work on the JNA project, like myself, I cannot publish any work or research or investigations of the kind of on this topic, like currently on Ukraine, on the editorial team of Bellycat. We cannot also publish this work because we intend for this for the incidents that we investigate to be used. In future court hearings, and therefore we have to preserve like a level of secrecy, as in any case of like any classical trial. I will end here, I will now give the floor to Charlie.
Thanks, Natasha. Thank you for. Going through what the JNA unit looks like. And it's such a privilege for me to be able to kind of virtually sit next to you, actually. It's quite surprising, really, that two Bellycat staff members or a Bellycat staff member and a consultant don't see much of each other. But because of the firewall mentioned, I'm on editorial, Tasha's in the JNA unit. We don't often get to speak to each other or work together. So it's such a privilege to actually share the stage with you today. Thank you also for kind of pre uh, preparing for some of the questions that might have come your way. I think you answered a couple of the audience questions already, which is really great, and gives some information. I put in the chat, by the way, the link to the Ukraine civilian harm map that was mentioned. And for those listening on the podcast, you can find that at ukraine.bellingcat.com. It's publicly available and has been available for a little while on our site. My first question, Natasha, before we go to audience questions, was I wanted to know whether, because you've mentioned this Ukraine civilian harm map, I wanted to know whether it is likely that we're actually going to see some of this work appear in war crime trials in Ukraine. Is that kind of one of the end goals of the unit? And is it likely that we might kind of see some of the evidence that we've collected actually seek justice and accountability in that region?
Mm-hmm. A short answer would be we hope so, but we don't know, because it really heavily depends on like the various authorities, like the local tribunals, the international special tribunals that it might appear in the future. We are now looking at kind of filling in the blind spots of kind of other evidence that is collected on ground, like in a more traditional way. So like, for example, in territories that are like harder to access, like the occupied territories or places where it's relatively, like for example, the places that are consistently under shelling, or like other various reasons that that kind of for the reasons that like people cannot, or the prosecutors cannot go on to those locations and investigate kind of more traditional ways, then the work that we produce kind of fills in those gaps. So yes, the answer would be we don't know if the kind of, considering the limitations of the evidence that we produce, we don't know if this will be admissible. But our kind of methodology is really kind of trying to make it possible.
And just as a follow-up to that, because you mentioned in the speech that, for example, you keep a level of secrecy for some of the data because of the fact that we're trying to get it admissible in court. So obviously the Ukraine civilian harm map is public data at the moment. Is that's not going to be the instance that the prosecutors and the judges see, right? They'll be looking at the more specified data that you mentioned in the database. Is that correct? Is that how we're keeping kind of the level of secrecy?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, because I think I did not really cover it well in the presentation. Yes, it's right, because the data that is kind of that you can see on the map is like this. A foundation. It's like everything that we collect goes onto this map. Everything related to civilian harm, whilst the reports that have kind of the potential to make it to the court hearings are kind of the more granular reports. They're of course based on those same incidents that you see on the map. Some of which will appear on the map. But they're kind of developed to a higher degree of details, and so it's those details do not appear on the publicly available database. I hope that answers the question.
Definitely, it gives us a lot more information. There's a few questions coming in. Sarah, one of our moderators, asked. Because obviously the civilian harm database you mentioned was put together using Atlas. Sarah asked, what would you say the value is of putting it on Atlas versus another kind of list or resource?
Another list of resource. This is an interesting question, I think, because there are actually like various databases that exist online. But I think from my kind of personal experience, Atlas is much more user-friendly than some of the other kind of existing spreadsheets that kind of collect all of this information. Plus is kind of moderated, and there's a kind of a specific guidelines to follow, which is not which is not always the case with other databases. And I also think that Atlas is setting up a good precedent for other databases to follow, because very often we log the same incidents and kind of do the same work twice. So I think it's Atlas is an important framework, or setting out kind of the guidelines on how this sort of databases can be managed. So from a kind of personal perspective, I think it's user friendly interface, as well as partially publicly available, the public availability of the information that we log, as well as the possibility to interact and kind of participate as a volunteer, to be active in this process. So I think it has all these qualities that, as I mentioned, some of the other databases do not have.
I've also got to mention that in the volunteer community, the Atlas kind of founders and employees have been really useful to answer questions as well, if we've had any questions on the software, and have been on hand to solve any problems as well, which has been really, really useful for our benefits as well, so that we can flag directly with them, which has been really nice to have that kind of relationship as well. Sarah says, thank you for your thoughts. I'm kicking around how best to set up an instance of Atlas to be most effective for a project. So yeah, there you go. That's our thoughts on that. We've got a couple of other questions. Fraser said, how do you think generative AI will impact your work? Or do you think that's more of a concern for investigators initially verifying data?
Just the question that we get a lot, in internal discussions as well, of course, especially in the past year, because this new technology, as well as it seems like it has a lot more it will change so much more and kind of become so much more realistic in the kind of in the coming months, days, weeks, years. So far, I would kind of first start off with kind of my personal experience. So far, I have not been able, I have not identified, it seems like it has not influenced our work so much yet, because it's still possible to identify if something was kind of AI generated or not. But I think in the future that might change. And I think also it's a there is like this it's kind of relatively easy if you have enough kind of evidence to corroborate, to prove that some an event took place, because we usually rely on various sources of information. But I think the problematic aspect of it that kind of makes me think harder and kind of excited to kind of explore this topic is actually that it's easy to say that everything is fake. So it will be much harder to kind of to prove that something. I think it's relatively easy to prove that an incident took place, but it's there's kind of this. General opinion that that it will be harder and harder I think it'll be kind of everything will be fake, the social media, and I think it will be So kind of this conversation is not to prove that something did not take place, but rather that that is not fake.
Yeah, I mean, we've proved previously at Bellingcat as well. You can find it on our guides that we haven't found an AI tool capable of reliably geolocating and chronolocating yet. If you do find such a tool that is able to geolocate with 100% accuracy or 99% accuracy, please do get in touch. We'd love to find out which AI tool is stealing our jobs. So please do get in touch. Keep your questions coming in the chat. There's a few more, but I wanted to ask one of mine first, if that's okay. Because you touched on the fact that you are an architect in your past life. That's your expertise. I wanted to understand a little bit more about the makeup of the JNA unit. What does it consist of in terms of expertise representation? And where can our audience read more about the unit itself as well?
Okay. The JNA unit is a relatively young organization. It's relatively young, and we at the moment only have a small micro site. I'm sharing my screen, so it's at the top right corner of the website that has a single page. But we are hoping to populated with more information in the future. The methodology is already publicly available. And also you can find more information on GLAN's website. And the first part of the question was the makeup of the team. We have a diverse, a relatively diverse team. So we have I think 10 people in total, 6 on the Bellingcat side and 4 people from GLAN. We come from various backgrounds. Myself, I have a background in architecture, but other people have background in law, in kind of in research and investigative work, as well as like data scientists.
And do you feel that your expertise kind of complements each other? Like, how do you use your architecture skill set on a daily basis in the JNA unit?
Okay. I specialize in kind of spatial investigations. I work much more with kind of the photographs and the kind of the videos, and I spend much more time trying to understand what am I seeing on those, kind of replicate, like to understand like the scale of things, like how far away an object is. And all of this kind of analysis then informs the reports that we produce. Maybe I can also add that, so the reports that we produce like multiple pages long, and this is like following the methodology, and it actually I think requires like a set of skills that are like kind of would require a multidisciplinary person, like someone who kind of skill sets like from various backgrounds to have like a very informative and kind of something. Kind of more dimensional. And I think that the conversations that we have within the team already informs that, but I think that kind of the strong sides of every person, be it kind of more in law, depending on the incidents, that can inform more or less like a specific every one of the reports.
Yeah, so all of your skill sets are kind of married together in this fantastic unit. And you said with your architecture skill set, you're focusing more on the like kind of the analysis of the destruction of buildings and things like that, and understanding how far conceivably the building was destroyed or something like that in terms of the civilian harm. Because Tristan's asked, one of our colleagues has asked in the chat, could you briefly discuss the relationship between architecture and open source research? So is that kind of the level of detail that you're going into? Are you assessing how much of the building is likely damaged using your skill set? Or is it simply just the geolocation part? And how far into the data do you go terms of what you can find out about what you're seeing in these videos?
I think primarily it's useful for geolocations, just kind of orientating in space and also like expecting kind of this navigation between the satellite imagery that is like very often available in the photographs that we have to geolocate. So kind of this idea of like switching between views more easily, or like sketching, for example, things that you would expect to see, is very helpful for geolocation itself. But I also think that the kind of the level of destruction. As an architect, I think I was kind of more used to like trying to understand how to put something together. Well, now what I kind of see on daily basis is like the kind of the opposite, the reverse of that is kind of the what was kind of left behind, and kind of the idea is to assess like what kind of for example, one of the questions that we have to answer is like part of this methodology is how what kind of munition was used, and that is often kind of assessed by like understanding like the level of destruction, and therefore understanding like whether a load-bearing wall was damaged or if it's like a lighter structure. So kind of figuring out, when I say like what assessing what we see on images and videos, it's possible to deconstruct this visual materials into like almost a data set. And for instance, like what is load bearing, what was the impact, and then based on that, decisions or like assumptions can be made. That would end up on the report. And this is like, this process is documented and well explained, so that the conclusions that we came up with actually are based on all of this kind of more granular information.
Thank you, that's super clear. And if you want to see an example of an open source research unit using kind of architectural models and using kind of an architectural mindset, Forensic Architecture, a really good example of this, where they're kind of building 3D models of spaces as well and looking at kind of different aspects of the space that they're analyzing. You mentioned, just going back to the makeup of the unit, you mentioned the kind of expertise that was in the unit, but it's also languages as well, because obviously it might be useful if, for example, on the team, you might have Russian or Ukrainian speakers. Is that represented in the team as well, in terms of being able to kind of read some of the signs that you might find in videos or images, for example?
Oh, yes, of course. Of course, we have investigators speak both Russian, some of the investigators on the team speak Russian and Ukrainian, and it's very, very useful in investigations, because we go through so much information while collecting, that is like, it's important to like quickly assess it, and sometimes very often there's like this kind of secondary level of information that is not written, that is easily translatable if you just use Google Translate or like automatic translation of the pages, which can be useful for people who do not speak the languages. But I find it, I speak Russian is my native language, and I also speak Ukrainian. I find it very useful because there's like this secondary kind of level of information that we can collect from videos, for instance, when like somebody describes an event or like mentions something behind the or like on the side, something that is not kind of that has like the audio component that has to be also analyzed and very often used for kind of additional to supplement the kind of the database and reports that we produce.
And also, I'm guessing familiarity with the area as well is also quite useful for geolocations. Tristan's just put, forensic architecture's investigation and model of the IDF's murder of Shireen Abu Akleh was incredible, and put a link into the in the chat there as well for people looking for forensic architecture examples. Jane asked a question earlier that relates to one of mine, actually. She said, any plans to expand this project to cover the civilian harm in Palestine? I don't know if you mentioned earlier, but previously the unit did look into Yemen. So is there a plan to look into other regions other than Ukraine and Yemen, or is it not about the regions you work on and rather the methodology?
Primarily, of course, we focus on kind of the development of the methodology that can be applied to any region, as long as it's kind of adapted to the said region. So the kind of the idea is like to make sure that kind of a methodology is developed so that it allows for the evidence produced and collected to be admissible in courts. So that is the primary focus. A short answer to your question, yes, we are looking into, we are also kind of, we are not looking yet, but we are thinking about expanding our unit to cover the conflict in Palestine.
Yeah, the hopeful plan is that, you know, our methodology might be usable by other outlets as well. Is that correct? So we're trying to kind of prove the case, and then if the case works, then it could be replicable by other outlets. But it's a lengthy process, isn't it?
Yes, it's a lengthy process with a lot of iterations. We're about to publish another version of the methodology. And as I said, this process requires a lot of testing, a lot of adjusting, and it will take some more time before this is kind of finalized taken to a more stable version. This is the process that is like we're focusing on and developing, and hopefully this is like a blueprint. This becomes a blueprint that other organizations can follow, and so this process is shortened for them and becomes kind of more it's more of an educational kind of process for us. Almost, we think about it not just as making sure that this works in this particular instance, but also something that can become a blueprint that can be taken, adjusted, and hopefully will save more time in the future for other organizations that are involved.
Fingers crossed. Keep your questions coming in, by the way. We've got about 20 minutes left. Meryl has asked, what are the main ways in which the methods of the JNA unit differ opposed to the methods of other Bellingcat staff members? So how does the way that you collect your data and do your reports differ from how, for example, Tristan, who's in the chat, might do an investigation on the Bellingcat editorial side?
It's an interesting question, because I have to say that I've mostly been on the JNA side of the firewall. So I'm much more familiar with the way we do work and because the firewall works so well, I have much less experience of working with the editorial team. But from what I know, I would answer this question with I think the kind of the primary the kind of the tools that we use are very similar. So we use the same kind of the spreadsheets to kind of accumulate data. We use the same sources. Like it depends on like the particular instance. For example, with the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, it would be platforms such as Telegram and VK and TikTok. Whilst an investigator who's looking into Gaza right now would be using more Facebook and Instagram and kind of platforms like that. So there is a kind of variation in we use the same kind of we use the same tools, but we have to kind of pay more attention to one side or another. I think the kind of the final result of the the information is then compiled into written text, which then is published online in case of the editorial team. But for us, although we do need to make sure that the narrative is kind of everything is coherent and it makes sense, I think we pay attention to the kind of first of all the methodology steps, and we have to frame it in kind of the legal. The legal terms that we have to pay much more attention to.
Yeah, as you mentioned in your speech, you're kind of taking the raw data and then kind of specifying where that kind of sits in the legal argument as well. I'd also note that I think on your side, you're taking a lot of more detailed notes about every action that you're taking. I mean, every Bellingcat researcher that goes through editorial will know that we do very vigorous fact checks, and we want to know exactly where you found information and then be able to trace it back to its source. But on the Justice Accountability Unit side, that they have to really note when, like at what time they found particular sources and really go into the granular details.
Yes. And maybe I can also mention that we use kind of the archiving part is like hyper important for us, because if that part fails at any point, that can we'll lose the argument within our report. So we actually record every single step so that the process that stays transparent and replicable no matter whether the evidence or like content disappears from the internet or not.
Yeah, you've basically got to take minutes like in a meeting. that's kind of how I've seen it very differ quite significantly. Also, the JNA unit is working quite closely with our volunteer community, which obviously doesn't work with every investigation on Bellingcat's editorial side. But with this project, they're working really closely and have worked really closely with the volunteer community for a long time, which is fantastic and something that's shown real impact from that particular group. I had a question. Has anyone else done similar work trying to get information sourced from online admissible in court? Has anyone else kind of tried to take steps in this direction before to drive accountability with online information or open source information?
So there are other organizations that use open source information for public reports, such as like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch. But I'm not sure whether they actually prepare it for to be admissible in courts. I know that GLAN has used the Yemen project which has been used in tribunals.
Meryl has just asked, actually, to link with that. Can you give some more information about the mock trials you did and what they thought of you? I think she's written. So could you give us a little bit of more detail about the mock trials itself? Perhaps speak a little bit about the verdict of those mock trials or the conclusions of them? Because I know some of that information is public. As far as I'm aware.
Yes, I think you can find more information on, like, they're actually, the mock trials are published online. And if you follow this link that I'm sharing right now, it's on Glan, the Austin mock trial. It has the two videos that have the mock trials documented. And the verdict of that trial is that the evidence provided in this hearing was actually admitted by the judge. And that is like the stepping stone for the work that we are. I'm sharing the screen, right? So this it is a stepping stone for the work that we are doing now on Ukraine. Maybe it's something to mention for this. Yeah, connected to the AI question, perhaps. This, like, it was interesting that this project was chosen, for testing grounds, and it was. Prior to all of the kind of the new technology that is emerging right now. So I think that the future kind of ways of testing this methodology will have to take into account this new emerging technologies, because this particular trial, although accepted the open source information as evidence, it has it was done at the time when it was much harder to manipulate this sort of information.
The trials were done in 2021. Is that right? In England and Wales?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, and you can, Natasha mentioned, you can actually watch the trials on the GLAN website that Tristan kindly linked in the comments, but I'll attach it to the episode description as well when this is launched as a podcast. And you'll see Nick Waters from our team played a defendant, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. The prosecution actually, the expert witness, I think, yeah, sorry, Sons of Life, I think you're right there. Sorry, legal speak is not my go-to. I believe the prosecution gave him quite a hard time as well, as far as I remember, which is quite funny and good to look at. Please keep your questions coming. You've got about 10 minutes for the final few questions. I wanted to ask how this work is funded, because a lot of the time we talk about how our investigations are funded and how our trainings work. But how is the JNA unit funded if it's separate to Bellingcat's reporting in terms of this firewall exists between editorial and the JNA unit? So how does the funding for it work?
The JNA is part of Bellingcat, and so we have like limitations of like who we accept the funds from, and very strict guidelines. And you can find this information on the website. It's publicly available. I'm not sharing the screen now, but you just can scroll down and find this information if you kind of want to find more details on this. JNA is not a standalone organization. The funding topics such as war in UK can be covered by Bellingcat grants that will be the kind of the short answer.
Sarah asked in the chat as well something related to a previous question, because I previously asked, has anyone previous any other organizations previously tried to bring a kind of open source research to courts? But Sarah's asked, do you know of any other organizations that are doing something similar right now to Galan and Bellingcat? Are you aware of anybody else in this space that is trying to do something similar?
Developing a methodology, you mean? I cannot really think of an organization that is doing like similar kind of work to us. There is like this Berkeley protocol that I've mentioned before that exists like as a framework, but this is like a high level framework, so it doesn't go into details, or it's not like a step-by-step guide of how to use the open source information as evidence. And so, yeah, I mean, I cannot think of an organization that is also involved in kind of developing a methodology that can then be not only applied like within a small organization, but is shareable for kind of a more a broader field of investigators.
Yeah, I think Nick had mentioned in his Nick Waters in the International Journalism Festival that we were in last week, and his talk on open source research for accountability purposes. He was saying how it's very much a pioneering model. It's not something that has kind of existed previously. Sarah says, well, that makes you guys even more necessary than I thought. So yes, the JNA unit is important. I'm really interested to know actually what has been the kind of reception from lawyers and judges. Have we put any effort into kind of educating lawyers and judges and general courtrooms on open source research techniques so they kind of understand what we're doing here and why this kind of information is useful?
I think this is a very, very like important process, actually, because apart from educating the investigators and kind of those who kind of collect and produce evidence, it's also important to educate those who will potentially admit this collected evidence. And although if you want to find out more information about this, I think it's it would be a good idea to reach out to some of the lawyers on the team. I can just say that part of this kind of testing of the methodology that we are discussing within the unit, one of the routes that we are kind of thinking of taking is actually an educational kind of program particularly for the judges potentially in Ukraine. Who would be dealing with cases that we are working with? Yeah, I think it's a very, very important issue. That is a process that runs both ways, and it's always like very important to think about it when we kind of talk about the methodology and the work that we do. To raise awareness, not just kind of in the realm of the investigators, but also by those who will be the recipients of the work that we do.
Yeah, and as Meryl's mentioned in the chat, it might be useful to kind of incorporate it in university programs. I think that's also been part of the discussion in terms of educating future law students as well on these kinds of methods and techniques, so that when they kind of are able to practice these kinds of techniques are forefront in their minds as an option for prosecution or defense, which I think is really, really useful to note. Lacey in the chat has asked a question related to this, actually. And again, Natasha, if you can't answer, don't worry. And this will be the final question as well, because of time. Lacey's asked, are there any examples of cases that would have been successful if open source research wasn't thrown out, or where the outcome might have changed significantly if this methodology existed or was used historically?
Oh, this is a very interesting question. I cannot really think of anything, but I would also, yeah, I would imagine that this is something to be asked from the lawyers on our on the team. But also, I imagine that this is something like an unknown. But I would really be interested to find out or think of a case, yes, that could have been affected had it been and its methodology been in place.
Amazing. So yeah, please do reach out to the Global Legal Action Network or to Bellicastione, you know, if you want to find out a little bit more about that. Oh, Lacey says, I just wonder if there was some particular losses that inspired anything. I think, as I mentioned at the beginning, this was kind of born out of a chat between lawyers and Bellingcat, Global Legal Action Network and Bellingcat, during a workshop. And I think what was identified at the time was that, for example, there was so much evidence available for the ongoing conflict in Yemen, but there wasn't, it wasn't kind of accessible for lawyers or legal teams to use. And I think that's how kind of the conversation between Bellingcat and Glan about launching such a methodology and such a project kind of was born, which I think is really central to why we wanted to showcase it today in the stage talk as well, because all of this is kind of coming to a head now, isn't it? And as you mentioned, we're awaiting the latest report from your team, which will kind of speak to that methodology and showcase what it looks like now. I'm sorry, I know a lot of you are putting in chats in the questions in the chat, but I do need to end the stage talk now because of time. If Natasha has time, she might be available to answer the questions in the chat. But for now, thank you so much, Natasha, for coming and for talking us through your work and your unit's work. And I'm really excited to see see the report when it comes out, and to hear more about your project, as we can make it available in public. As I mentioned, all of the links that have been put into the chat today will be put in the description of the podcast. And you can find out more information about the Justice Accountability Unit on the Bellingcat website, and which will hopefully have a revamp very soon. And the Global Legal Action Network has a fantastic page and resource on the work as well. And you can check out some of the work that we've done in Ukraine on ukraine.bellingcat.com. Thank you so much, Natasha. I will end the podcast there. Thanks. Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.